Coming up on the brand new Joan Hamburg podcast, let me tell you, you are going to meet one of my pals and hear how he grew up to become Alan Alda. Fascinating stories and life's lessons for all of us. Please join us. Welcome to Let Me Tell You, on my, Joan Hamburg, my new podcast, which, by the way, you can get any time. Now, a lot of people have said to us, how do we get this podcast, which is going to be filled with really interesting celebrity and behind-the-scenes interviews, features about all the things you love to do, places you want to go to. Well, it's very easy. Don't forget, it's available always. You can get the link on our social network, or you can go, and this is simple, the OG Podcast Network.com. The other thing is, my daughter Lizzie was visiting the other day, and she said, oh, I want to hear your new podcast. I heard you had Michael Wolff on. So I said, yeah, I did. And it was interesting because I didn't really attack him. I really wanted to find out, who is this guy? You know, what makes him tick? How did a guy like this end up in the White House for 7 months? So my daughter, who makes fun of me because of my lack, she thinks, of tech abilities, goes into the dining room where Alexa, and you know, at a certain age, you call it anything. Alexa, Alexandra, she responds, where Alexa is there, and she said, Alexa, get the Joan Hamburg podcast. Honestly, I still don't get it. Within 2 seconds, the Joan Hamburg podcast came on. So it's time for Granny to become tech and hip. It's the easiest way to do things. So you've either got the OG Podcast Network.com or go get yourself one of those Alexa deals. And my husband, it's almost funny. What do you think he asks her all the time? What's the temperature outside? So, I mean, that's what it's all about. All right. So we had a big week, because one of my favorite holidays, Chinese New Year, has started, and it's really going full swing. In fact, Sunday, there's a Lunar New Year parade and festival right in Chinatown, Mott and Canal Street, and it is so much fun. Everyone's in costume. It's crazy, but it's great. And that's something that the whole family can do. There's all kinds of events. And you should take yourself to some of my favorite restaurants. I love the Numhua restaurants. They're all doing great stuff. The latest is Numhua 2, TU, at 22 Orchard Street. And they're going to be doing specials. Try their turnip cakes. Yummy. And their rice cakes. They've got a hollowed out dragon fruit and sesame bowl deal with chocolate sauce. And the prices are pretty reasonable. You know what's a great restaurant that most of us don't know about? It's been hailed as like the best thing in Chinatown or near Chinatown, Little Tong Noodle Shop, 177 First Avenue in the East Village, littletong.com. They're doing specials all the time. This was called one of the best new restaurants when it opened months ago, and it was in the Cheap Eat section too. They've got 16 days of Chinese New Year goodies. Try their dumplings. I really love it. The chef, Simone Tong, a very interesting young woman. I'm going to try to get her on the air here. And I always love Oriental Garden on Elizabeth Street, one of my favorite streets between fashion and Chinese restaurants It's a winner. And they have fish tanks where shrimp, live shrimp, are swimming around, and you sort of point to what you want and they make it, and they have delicious dim sum. And then, of course, Ed Schoenfeld, who isn't Chinese, Jewish, but the leading authority on Chinese food practically in the country, he has Red Farm, a restaurant at 529 Hudson, and one uptown west side in Manhattan, 2170 Broadway. They have like pastrami, egg roll, and all kinds of goodies. It's a lot of fun, and it's very lively. So I'm just getting you started with some of the things I love. And then coming up today, I'm really having an in-depth conversation with my pal, Alan Alda, one of the great actors of our time. And why Alan Alda, at this point, would rather talk science than he almost would talk theater. A superb actor, works constantly, a writer, a humanitarian. So come join us and really meet Alan. There's no nicer person or more talented person. Anyway, we're going to do this every Friday. And then don't forget, get it whenever you want. So I really want you to be with me. I'm Joan Hamburg. And hang out, because we've got a great interview right ahead. Everyone, you are part of, let me tell you, our new show with Joan Hamburg. And I have one of my favorite people sitting in the studio. And I really feel like saying, will the real Alan Alda stand up? Because Alan is not only an actor, a writer, a director, he knows more about science than almost anyone.
Not more than scientists.
Yeah, we know more from you because you know how to tell us about it.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And what Alan is on a mission now to teach scientists and all the rest of us how to communicate. And this is from a man who's won Emmys, Tonys, Television Hall of Fame, and you know him as Hawkeye from MASH, many, many movies. And many books. My favorite, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed, which really happened to him, and other things I've learned. And the book that people are still talking about now, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. So welcome.
Thank you. And isn't it wonderful that you have this series of conversations about communicating and relating? Huh?
Well, you know, communication is such an art, and most people don't get what they want because they don't know how to do it.
Right, or they get who they want and then get fed up with them because they can't talk to each other.
That's my favorite, is when you go to a restaurant, and I always say to my husband, I bet they're married.
Because nobody's talking.
No one talks. They silently chew. Trying to look as if they're having a good time. And every now and then I see them sneaking a look at their Apple Watches, which they can't read anyway.
It is amazing how there's so much to talk about. And sometimes when you have the person who is probably the most interesting person in the world to you, or ought to be, the line goes dead. Why is that? Why do you think that you and Skip, your husband, do you talk all the time, constantly with each other?
You must be kidding. You've been with us. Absolutely not.
No kidding. I'm so busy talking, I don't notice if you're talking.
No, but, you know, one day he said in the car as we were driving out to the east end of Long Island, at least a 2.5-hour trip when there's warm weather, you talk for a living. Why can you not talk when we're in the car? I say, I'm talked out. That's it.
Oh, that's...
But that's not good. I mean, talk.
He has, I'm sure, plenty to say.
He has plenty to say, but I have to want to listen to plenty.
Well, I have the opposite problem. When I'm invited to dinner with Arlene, my wife.
Right, who very talented.
And comes up with thoughts that I never hear. The rest of the time, we'll be at dinner and she'll say something. She's at the other end of the table and she's saying something I never heard her say before. And I think, when did she have time to think that up? And I strain to listen to her instead of whoever I'm with at my end.
The person next to you.
Yeah.
Well.
Who has an interesting golf game to tell me about.
I know, but it's, as we get a little bit older, we get a little shorter in patience.
Well, we also get a little shorter.
Shorter. That is very
Arlene
annoying.
Arlene has lost a couple inches, but she doesn't seem shorter to me because I've lost a couple of inches.
No, but she was a short person to start with.
That's right. Now I can't find her.
I was a very tall person. I can't imagine what happened. I literally gave up the best catch in my neighborhood when I was a kid because he was so short.
Oh, I thought you were going to marry a fish.
No, no, that's already been done in a movie.
Oh, that's right. How do they do that?
I don't know. People say, did you love that movie, that water movie? I said, there's something a little unreal about some nice lady falling in love with a giant fish. However.
Well, the thing that I worried about was for the rest of her life now she has to eat worms.
And live underwater. It's bad for your hair.
That's hard. But somebody told me that I missed the shot where this happens. He turns her neck into a set of gills at the end of the movie. I missed that.
But you know what? In this movie, which is being nominated for every award.
I think
award,
it's a brilliant piece of work. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it was interesting. I didn't love it as much as you did, but the character had scars on her neck.
Right.
Remember that in this film? Those scars were gills, and that's part of this whole...
Oh, I think she...
We don't want to give everything away.
Yeah, don't give everything away.
But, you know, it isn't unlikely that you'll end up with a fish when you see it.
I thought it was a really good movie, but I'm eating more steak now.
That's a very good idea. Alan Alda, whose latest book, Can Change the Way You Communicate, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. But Alan was not always, you were always a communicator, but you started off as a young boy hanging out with your dad at burlesque houses.
Right. Now that's communication.
But there is something about the body language that definitely makes people relate.
And I got plenty of body language as a little boy. I was two and a half years old, standing in the wings, watching strippers and chorus girls.
Daddy was a burlesque star.
He was a straight man and a singer. And I really got an education in the theater, watching comics from the side, from the wings. I didn't realize until I was much older that there's something very different about watching a performer from the side like that, only a couple of feet away, while they're creating an illusion for the audience. If you're in the audience, you're seeing the illusion as it's created. You're getting the illusion. When you're standing beside them, you can see in a way where the magician hides his pigeons.
Mm. But that was your life for many years.
Yeah, well, for several years. And then my father went into nightclubs.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Still a young man, he got a job in the movies, and his first movie was starring as George Gershwin in the film biography of Gershwin called Rhapsody in Blue.
Which was a huge film.
Yeah, and that was my first exposure to what stardom was like, because it was so unlike what we had lived up until then. Up until then, we were living in little hotel rooms with green painted wood slatted walls, you know.
Yeah, the what everyone imagines those early days were like in vaudeville and the road.
So
was your mother sick early on?
She eventually was diagnosed as having schizophrenia and paranoia, but she was, I could see depression in her eyes as an early boy.
You knew.
I remember her turning away from the window that she was looking out of when I was about six, and I, even younger than that, and I saw a strange look in her eye. When I was 6 years old, she tried to stab my father. So that was a sort of an indication something was wrong.
A little touch.
Yeah.
A little hint. And Alan writes about all this, but you know what, and this is real, you are one of the best adjusted people I know. Now, seriously, you know, everyone's got stuff in life. You had a lot of stuff as a kid,
well,
coming
I did,
of age.
I did. But, you know, I think one thing that helped me, And I don't know if I'm so well adjusted, but thank you. But one of the things that helped me function was that my mother gave me such a distorted sense of reality, her version of it. You know, watch out, they're taking our pictures through the crack in the wall, that kind of thing.
Did you believe it when you were a kid?
No, that's what was good for me. I had to constantly think,
what's
is
real?
This real or is this just the
your
way
mother.
She talks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the other thing that saved me was another woman, was my wife, Arlene, when we married. Yeah. That, to me, that marriage, that
saved
wedding anniversary
you.
Date was the second birthday I had.
That was amazing. And you met her at a dinner, as
at
I
a
recall.
Dinner, well, it was the second time we met. The first time we met, she was playing clarinet.
Well, she's a musician
yeah,
as well.
She was
a photographer and writer.
A professional musician at the time. And she was playing the Mozart clarinet quintet at somebody's house where I was invited to just listen. And I thought she was beautiful and wonderful and talented, and I was so shy. All I could say to her at the end of the evening was, that was good. The next time we met was at dinner at the same apartment. And I noticed she was laughing at my jokes, which was making me
big.
Really attracted to her. And then the hostess's rum cake fell off the refrigerator and hit the floor. And Arlene and I were the only two people to go in with spoons and eat the cake off the floor. So that did it. You know, if you flirt over food, you're in.
And especially food on the floor.
Food on the floor is the absolute apex of flirting.
But then where did the science come in? Because that wasn't part of your life early on. I mean, you...
No, but I was always curious, and I always was trying to do what I thought were experiments. I would, when I was about 6 or 7, I would mix things I found around the house to see if I could get them to explode.
That, which...
Thank goodness I wasn't tall enough to reach the things that would explode.
That's right. So that was always an interest, and yet acting took over.
I wanted to be a writer before I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a writer as early as the age of 8. Later in life, at the age of 9, I wanted to be an actor.
Well, which is interesting, because
yeah.
Boys, girls have that early on, but more of a princess thing.
Do most girls want to be a princess?
Yeah.
Really?
Girls are into it. If you go to any toy store, what sells out? Tiaras, princess costumes. Huh. Little girls want to be princesses till they're like 8, 9 years old.
That's interesting. I wanted to be a writer.
Which is very unusual.
Yeah, but...
Did you write as a little kid, write your thoughts?
I did. I had a book I loved called Top Horse at Crescent Ranch, and I wanted to write a book that would be completely original and have nothing to do with that book I loved. So I wrote a story called Not the Top Horse at Crescent Ranch. Don't you think that's
I like that.
A clean break?
Exactly. Exactly. And what happened with that?
I don't know. I never saw it again.
So what determined that acting was going to do it? Was MASH the first thing that was so life-changing? You were
now
married.
Well, it really did change. Yeah, it changed our lives. But up until then, I just worked my way up little part by little part, acting, getting parts. I was playing leads on Broadway. And then, you know what's funny? What made it possible for me to act on television, while I was acting on Broadway, I was doing game shows like What's My Line and To Tell the Truth. And that, they had what they called then, maybe they still have it, a TVQ rating. Do people know you? And if they know you, do they like you? Whoever you are, they don't even really know you, but they see you on TV.
Yeah, that's right.
So I had a high rating from these stupid game shows. And that's why they started hiring me on television.
And when MASH came to you, it was like, right?
Well, no. I got the script while I was in the Utah State Prison.
What were you doing there?
Well, I happened to be making a movie there.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was the best script I read while I was in prison. And I said, I'd like to do it. But I called Arlene. I said, you know, they make this in California. And we live in New Jersey with our children.
Yeah, a bunch of kids.
Yeah, I don't want to rip them up out of there. Home life. And I said, this show could, you know, it could possibly run a whole year. It ran 11 years.
And it's still running.
Yeah, you're right.
It's still there.
So Arlene said, well, if it's that good, maybe we can solve the problem with travel. So I did. For a few months every year, I'd fly back every weekend.
And then even you, I think, was startled by the enormous success
of the show. We all were. The show, when it went on, it was against very popular and entrenched shows. So people weren't looking at it. We were at the bottom of the list. I used to say we're in the top 78.
Which is a good thing to be.
Yeah, somewhere on the list. So when the rerun started, people had already seen our competition, and then they tried us out. And after that, we were sailing.
Sold.
It was really nice.
And with that came theater and other great opportunities. But science, you started doing a science show.
When MASH was finished, I
got
a letter.
Right, but that was 11 years.
Yeah, 11 or 12 years after we started MASH. I got a letter asking if I'd like to host a science show. And I figured they just were looking for somebody with some kind of public profile who could say, this is the show this week, and then disappear and read a narration. I don't think they knew I had a special interest in science. You know how I could tell? Because it was addressed to Dear Occupant. Well, not quite.
No, but I get it.
I can't resist a dumb joke.
Yeah, but that's a good joke because Occupant rose to the occasion.
Yeah, and I said, would you let me actually interview the scientists on camera, because then I'd get to spend the whole day with them and learn from them about what they did. I was, in a way, less interested in doing the show than just spending the day with a bunch of scientists. And we did that for 11 years, and I must have interviewed about 700 scientists. And in that process, I found something remarkable, which is that they weren't ordinary interviews. They were more like what you and I do when we get together.
We
just have a conversation. And that open conversation that could go anywhere meant that they weren't making mini lectures at me or at the camera. They were actually responding to my questions, and I was responding to their answers, so that sometimes it went off in directions nobody expected. The more they did that, the more the real them came out. And they weren't just scientists who were gurus in white coats on top of a mountain. They were people, smart people, who were curious and interested in letting us know what they did. They see it. They see under the rug of the universe. They see what's growing under the rug. They're amazingly astute investigative reporters. They know stuff that, if they can explain it to us clearly, just makes our minds spin. So I realized after the show was over, if I could get them to do that, what we did together on the air, to do it every time they faced an audience, to make that intimate personal connection, we'd all know more about science and the world would be a lot better off, because we'd help science get to the places that help us. And so I realized what did it for me was studying improvisation. So I teach scientists improvisation.
And was it hard getting scientists to say, I really want to do this?
You know, in the beginning, it was not that easy. I started the Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. I helped start it. And even on that campus, in the beginning, it was hard to get heads of departments to say, yes, we want you to take the time to train our graduate students. Some people would say, we have too much science to teach. Well, right. Communication is part of
science. Exactly. It's part of teaching, too.
Yeah. You can't really spread science or get funded for it unless you can explain what it is. So what's happened since we started 9 years ago, we've trained over 11,000 scientists and doctors and nurses, and the idea of learning to communicate better has grown so much that we can hardly meet the demand now for our workshops.
Well, you know, you hear people complain about doctors all the time, everyday stuff.
Yeah.
And it's what you are doing. They don't know how to communicate.
And so, there's so much more pressure on doctors not to communicate well than they had before. Now they have only a few minutes of time with you, dictated by the insurance company.
And
they're putting down all the data they get from you on a computer, so they're not even facing you.
Exactly.
In many
cases. They're on their devices.
Yeah.
There.
So we help them be eager not to do that, to really make contact, because doctors tell us when they're really relating to the patient, they get so much more information from the patient than the mere symptoms they tell them about. And the patient begins to trust the doctor.
Right, which is so important.
And if they don't do that, they don't get well as fast.
Have you found now that this skill that you've really honed, where you can teach it to scientists and to doctors, to people who basically are technical people and don't think like that or have not been thinking like that, can you translate that to ordinary people?
Yes, and
like
we
it's essential in
we
life.
Have done that, and we started up a separate company, which is a profit-making company, but all the profits go to the Center for Communicating Science. I don't take any money from it. And what we do is we go to corporations and help. We'll be training them in leadership skills and teamwork. And our first program is really wonderful. It's a workshop for women in business. It's called Power Connection, and it strengthens their communication skills and enables them to get what they need to be able to use what they have in a corporation and not be held back by not being listened to, having their ideas taken from them, all the things that women have to put up with still, amazingly still. And this enables them to brush that aside and get where they want to go.
If they had known that, the Me Too movement would have maybe had a different...
It may be that little things, relatively minor things like being interrupted or having your ideas deftly mm-hmm. taken away from you, those relatively minor things might build up to more serious transgressions that Me Too is dealing with. And this may be possibly some help along the way with that.
I think so. And now you've taken this all over the world. Alan is about to go off to the Middle East to lecture.
We have doing a workshop in Haifa in Israel, and I'll be talking there before the workshop. It's very interesting. You know, I love to talk about this, and I do an entertaining talk, but that doesn't accomplish it. So many times I get asked to talk as if that's going to accomplish this quest
just
for better.
Just make it happen.
Yeah. It's an experience you have to go through. It's like if you never played the piano before and suddenly you have a date to play the piano in Carnegie Hall on Friday night, I wouldn't say to you, here's three good tips to remember when you get out on stage. You got to know a little bit more about playing the piano. So that's what our workshops do. It puts you through experiences that aren't a list of tips.
They're real.
They transform you. You get accustomed to relating to the people you're talking to, and you think about what they're thinking about while you're talking with them. So just like when we're talking now, I see you watching my face. You're watching for what I'm really saying, what I'm really thinking. You know what the transition is to the next thought, because you're paying attention to everything coming out of me. And I'm doing the same with you, which is why we're able to have an actual conversation.
I know. It makes such a difference. So let me ask you, a famous producer like Scott Rudin comes up with a new brilliant play. Would you do it now? Alan is always working, film, television, plays. Would you, or is science too?
No, it's not that science calls. So much as I love being on the stage. I'm more at home on the stage because that's where I began as a boy.
Right.
I'm more at home there than I am in front of a camera. But it really does take over your life. It's not just 2 hours a night. You wake up in the morning thinking, is my voice going to work tonight?
Do you?
I have a cold? When should I eat? When should I nap? Everything revolves around that. And if you try to do something else like write and act at the same time, very hard. Well, first of all, they see the pencil in your hand. It's no good.
But if the right thing came along, would you or you feel you've been there, done that?
I kind of doubt it. I doubt that I would do it right now.
Well, you have. You've been there and you've done that and had a lot of great adventures.
But I get the pleasure of performing when I give a talk. It's mm-hmm. almost like a one-act play. And I love that contact with the audience. It's scary. You know, you don't know where it's going to go sometimes. But to actually show up, I would like it if they'd put up on the marquee, Alan feels like acting tonight. You know where I get that from? I get that from Arlene, who had a little plaque on the dining room table that she wrote once in a while. Arlene feels like cooking tonight.
I like that. I've got to take that. She can make a lot of money.
It reminds me of one of our daughters has a sign in the kitchen that says, You have two choices for dinner. Take it or leave it.
No, well, in my house, I have a sign that says, a swinging sign, Martha Stewart doesn't live here. I love that, you know, because she's for real. I mean, that's the way she lives.
She likes that.
Everything is perfect.
I like Arlene's approach, which is much more improvisational. She has a sign in the kitchen that says, dinner is ready when the fire alarm goes off.
It's true. And your wife really cooks.
She's a good cook. There's nothing in the house. And she says, how about dinner? I said, well, we don't have anything. She looks in there. She finds things that she makes a delicious meal out of.
Yeah,
that's improvisation.
I don't know how she does that. Or she'll say, come for dinner.
Yeah.
Communication. And the dinners are always where people talk. You know, you don't always have that.
No, I know. And I like to have the right number of people.
So you can hear.
So you can hear, and they don't naturally split off into two conversations.
No,
if you have about eight people, seems to be the limit.
That's good. But your wife does something smart, too. She puts little candy and goody dishes all around the table.
Yeah, nuts and candy.
Yeah, no matter what you're eating, all those little treats are waiting for you. So if you don't
that's
feel
all,
like,
by the way, you know, that to me is a form of communication. When you look at, you sit down at the dinner table, and somebody's done something to make you chuckle. Oh, look, peanuts all over the table, or little candies. Somebody has communicated to you, let's have a good time. It's like when I buy something at the store and the company communicates with me by making a package that I can't get into without a sledgehammer. This is a communication.
No, but you do that. Your house says hello.
That's right.
And, I mean, I'll never forget the first time I went to your house. And it was just a few of us. And there was a cloth covering something. And your wife said, do you want to play ping pong? I said, where? She said, I'll just get rid of the tablecloth. She took the tablecloth away. And I said, but that's what we're eating later. And we played ping pong.
Yeah, see, that's nice. That we multiple purpose things in your house. It's good.
Alan Alda with a book that is fairly current. And I still love, and you have to read it because it makes you laugh and it makes you appreciate what survival is about. Never have your dog stuffed and other things I've learned. But if I understood you, would I have this look on my face? My adventures in the art and science of relating and communicating. Can anyone learn to communicate? Anyone?
I think almost everybody can learn to communicate better, including people who can communicate well now. They can get better. They can relate more. They can have more empathy, which helps them understand what the audience is going through while they're communicating with them. But I've seen people who are shy and withdrawn and don't really want to look the other person in the eye get much better because these games we play, these exercises we do in our training are fun, and you come out of yourself in a joyful way.
Yeah, and it can also change the way you work, if you volunteer, anything. Change the way you get along with people. Everyone wants to be listened to, and that's a gift.
That's true. It's absolutely true.
Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Joan. How nice to talk to you again.
I love it. Alan Alda, go find out. You can actually take a class, can you? Do you have to be a scientist?
Yeah, well, the Women for Business, I'm
that's such
really
a good
eager
idea.
That's found at the Alda Center, beg your pardon, that's found at the Alda Communication Training Company. And the acronym of that is ACT.
I like it.
ACT. And we can line up training for women in business right now and then more training for corporations as time goes on.
Great. Or women who want to start a business. You have
yes.
to know how to reach out, even if you're trying to raise money.
You got to be able to get on the phone and explain what's on
exactly.
your mind in 30
Fast,
seconds.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like that old PR lesson. If you don't get the message in the second paragraph, don't bother.
Now it's second paragraph?
Now they're trying to be a little more subtle. Second paragraph. First paragraph, you warm them up. Second paragraph, you go for it.
Yeah.
Third paragraph, you beg. And then it's over. The one and only, Alan Alda. All the best to you. Have a good trip to Israel. We'll talk soon.
Thanks, Joan. Bye.
And I'm Joan Hamburg. Thank you so much for sharing this. And there's more to come. Stay tuned.